The first verse that we're looking at is working with anger. I'm going to say 7 or 8 different methods of working with anger off the top of my head. There are probably more, but that'll probably be enough for our purposes this evening. Yes, Perry? Okay.
Eager meeting.
All of which I failed the other yesterday. I'm going to start at the top. Remember a couple of weeks ago we talked about 3 levels of working with things. So the first level, which is the direct awareness, is that as anger arises, you experience it as clarity. Now, it's not that as anger arises you think, oh, this is the clear aspect of my mind. That's nothing. It's that your mind, you've trained so deeply that as anger arises, you experience it as clarity. Which actually, I've had a couple of times, and it's really quite interesting. Because you feel the surge of energy and everything just becomes totally clear. And there isn't any anger in you. And that's basically the Mahamudra / Dzogchen level, and it comes from training very, very deeply in that. The second level is to experience anger as something which brings energy into your mind, into your experience, and recognize that, or relate to that energy as you would, as just that arising of energy, seeing it as a manifestation of the awake aspect of mind. This is basically what you do with Yidam meditation. I don't want to go too much into that because it's a little too complicated for this evening. The third level, I'm going to give you 4 techniques at this level, is working with the emotional component. Now, the 4 techniques are based on the 4 ways of working: power, ecstasy, insight, and compassion. And each one works a little differently. The power technique as the anger arises in you, you stand right in the experience of the anger arising. And you cut your involvement with the anger and its projections. What you cut it with is attention. Now, if you want a little taste of that, imagine some incident that irritated you in the last few days or week or so. Let it come to mind. And say to yourself, I'm angry and I'm glad. And what happens? You find all of the force goes out of the anger, right? It's cutting it. The second technique at this level is opening, it's the ecstatic technique, it's opening to the experience of anger. So you can take that same incident and just feel every manifestation of that anger in you. How do you experience it in your body? How does it affect your breathing? What are all of the emotional sensations connected with it? What are the stories that it spins and propels in your mind? Now, when you do that, what happens to the anger? Okay. The third technique is insight. You let the anger arise and you look right at it. What is it? And when you look right at it, what do you see? Anybody?
Nothing.
Nothing. You don't see anything. If you train, so there you know, the anger is no thing. And if you've trained in that sufficiently, that releases right there. The fourth technique is compassion. I'm going to do a slightly different take on this one. What is the function of anger in our lives?
To protect us.
Right. So you look at that anger and you say, what are you doing? And it says, I'm protecting. Right? Now, how do you feel about the anger?
Grateful.
Pardon?
Grateful.
You're grateful. Is loving kindness and compassion come quite naturally for the suffering that is inherent in the anger? Now what happens to the anger? It releases because it is accepted, which is and that letting go of control. So you're no longer regarding anger as the enemy, as the essence of the loving kindness compassion approach. This is at a deeper level than one's usually takes it, but that's how you can work with all four of them. Now, if you can't do any of those things, then you come to, I guess it's the seventh technique. So I said we've had seven or eight here, and that is patience. Just, this is happening, can't do anything about it, don't like it, not getting very far trying to transform it or just let it release or anything like that. I will just sit here and grin and bear it and experience it. So you aren't acting on it. Okay?
And what about, what am I trying to oppose?
Joe?
And, the popping out of the hell realm, what am I trying to oppose with that?
Yes, that's another technique. That is primarily about cutting through or releasing the projections. You okay?
Yeah.
Wow.
My bubble burst.
That's about releasing the projections which come out of the anger. And as you do that, you step out of the realm and you find yourself, well, there isn't actually any need to oppose anything here.
And does that fall into one of the four ways of working?
Well, actually, it has elements of all four of them, asking those three questions.
And saying I'm angry and I'm glad feels like opening, which makes me think of
ecstasy.
But it's more of a a sharp opening.
Yeah, you see, when you say I'm angry and I'm glad, you're stepping right into the experience of anger. Mm-hmm. That's why I say it's the power of a power approach rather than just opening to the experience. You're just stepping right into it. Bang. Yeah. And it's
okay.
Done.
It's a sharp turn.
It's just a step. And you know, and you don't necessarily, as you train this, you don't need to say I am glad. You can just step right into the experience. Randy?
Since I've been home from the retreat, I've stepped into many situations where anger has arisen in the past and it didn't arise. I look at these, I haven't thought it through intellectually or through these things. It just hasn't arisen.
Good.
No, I understand. Good, but any... Yeah. Would I be going through this unconsciously in some way, or...?
It's more likely that because of the work we did in the retreat, that you are bringing a higher level of attention. So what normally would have triggered reactions is just being experienced. And that's the result of regular meditation practice. And doing retreat takes that up a notch. So that what would for some people be irritating and annoying is just experienced as something and you just work with it. Because you're letting go of things inside much faster than you were previously.
Is that a technique?
No, that, well, let's be clear here. When we say a technique, generally speaking, we don't mean something that we pull out of the hat, pull out of our bag of tricks in the moment. We mean something that we train in so that when the situations arise, it just happens. It doesn't require remembering. And this is what makes this level of, this approach to practice level of, difficult for many people to appreciate, because they want something that they can remember to do. Well, we never remember to do it because the reactions are always in operation. What we have to do is train in this so that when those situations are provoked, our training just clicks in.
Like in sports, muscle memory after...
Yeah, and you can think of this as mind memory or whatever.
Not to get too far off on the track on this, Ken, but on the second one, on the ecstatic technique where you just had us do that little drill, I just went spinning much more deeply off into the anger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, when you try any of those four techniques at that level, you will find that some will work for you and others won't. In particular situations, there's a lot to depend on our individual configuration. I would suggest that if you find yourself, as you open to the anger, you find yourself spinning more and more into the anger, there's something you're holding on to, and that would be might be an interesting thing for you to explore. There's another level of holding. Maybe not to do with this situation, maybe to do with something else where there's a basic posture of opposition. So, as Perry was suggesting a few moments ago, the when you find yourself feeling that anger that way, you could ask yourself those three questions. What am I opposing? Do I need to oppose this? Is opposing called for at all? And you may find that what you're opposing is very different from the ostensible or apparent source of the anger. And I remember working with one person who was very, very impatient with assistance. And we went over this very carefully when he had blown up for absolutely no reason, no substantial reason. And what came out was that whenever an assistant screwed up, it resonated with his own fear of being incompetent. And that was what he, that was his opponent. And that's what he couldn't experience. So everything was a projection after that. Steve wanted to ask a question, so if you want.
Thanks. Anyone want to hear a number off my new CD? Oh, sorry. wrong place. It says, if you don't subdue the opponent inside as opposed to an opponent inside. And I'm curious about that.
Well, yes. The opponent inside is your own anger. So that's how...
But what I'm saying is this implying that of all of the different reactivities, I mean, there's fear, there's doubt, there's other opponents, or is there's...
Oh, he's not using opponent in the sense of that we've used opponent in other contexts. He's just saying you have this anger coming up in you. If you don't subdue that, then it doesn't matter what you do out in the world, doesn't matter how much force you exert, you're never going to be free.
So it's not elevating anger to a greater relevance in reactivities? Or
No. Just saying
it's
this.
It's about anger.
It's about anger, yeah. That's right. Julia?
Yes, when I did that little mental exercise, I found the anger went away, but I was left with a huge amount of energy in my body.
Yep.
So what does one do with that?
Pour it into attention. That's your reward.
You have all. Decide wants to run off and do other things like eat chocolate cookies or dig the garden or.
Well, you can do that if you want, but basically the aim in that kind of transformation technique is yes, you flip it like that. All of that energy is available to you, which was ordinarily locked up in the anger. Mm. And now you can just rest and let that power your attention. That's what all advanced meditation techniques in the Tibetan tradition do, is that they transform emotional energy into attention, release emotional energy from being locked into reactive emotions. If you don't use it for attention, guess what happens to it? Goes in, decays into other habituated patterns,
right,
such as chocolate.
And gardening. Thank you.
Got you. Okay. Deborah?
One way of dealing with it is when the experience comes up that you know would cause anger and you sense the gap.
Okay.
And yep. Then you don't react because you're in the gap.
Yes.
Where does that fit in? And how would that be explained?
Well, you just explained it. and that's coming from our work at the retreat, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That stepping into that gap is basically, that's almost at the level of the Mahamudra Dzogchen techniques that I was describing. You sense it is arising and you immediately step into what is opening right there. Which is the gap? Good. Yeah, and when you pick things up that early, they're much easier to take care of. The transformation happens more smoothly and is less disruptive and so forth. Yeah, and that's an excellent way to practice.
I just want to clarify for myself that what it seems to me is that anger is always caused by opposing experience or fighting experience, so therefore anger is always a reactive pattern?
Yes. Anger is a reactive pattern because it... In anger, you see the object of anger as something other. You know, and, I mean, there may be very, very good reason for it. Now, at Vajrayana level, there's another way of looking at it. And that is that anger is the intelligence of the universe telling you that a boundary has been violated. And so now you can look, okay, where is the boundary being violated? And then you can seek to address that in the appropriate way. The comparable one for desire is that desire is the intelligence of the universe telling you that a connection has been broken. Because suddenly, I want that. When the connection's there, there isn't any sense of desire. There's just a flow of energy and response. But when it's broken, then there's that wanting.
Along the lines of what Elizabeth just said, isn't there such a thing as righteous anger? It seems that I've read about that in some of my readings, and an anger that comes up in response to the mistreatment of other beings, for example.
Well, you see other beings being mistreated, other people, whatever. What's the first thing you feel?
Compassion.
Right. First thing you feel is compassion. Now, when does the anger arise? This is important.
Doesn't it come up when you find an opportunity to deal with what's causing the suffering?
I would say it arises when you realize you can't, in your position, you can't do anything about the cause of the suffering, so you now fall out of the compassion into anger. Mm. And then you try to defend it by calling it righteous anger. There was a person down in Orange County who was making, it was back in the early 90s, and he was expressing his anger at the homeless people. And he was training with me in taking and sending at the time, so he's experiencing a bit of cognitive dissonance, shall we say. I said, why are you angry with the homeless? They are the products of the system. You know, if you want to help the homeless, why don't you call the mayor? You've got influence here. And put pressure on him. And moving from anger at the homeless because they were disturbing his sense of what his community should look like to actually taking action was way too big a step for him. And so anger comes up because you feel impotent and you're trying to control the situation. And then it's defended as righteous anger, which is used as the justification for violence. It's not, ever. And once you go down that road, you're going down the road of fundamentalism, terrorism, taking what is essentially compassion, turning it into an ideology where now the ends justifies the means, and compassion goes out the window, and you're just trying to make the world conform to how you think it should be. Does this make sense to you? That too strong?
I could just see a situation where someone's doing something wrong.
You could see a situation?
A situation arises where someone is harming a child.
Yes.
Or a dog. And you're standing right there. And compassion arises for the dog or the child, and then anger at the person to move them away.
One of my students applied to work with abuse situations. A person that was going to admit her to the training said, you walk into a room, you see a child bloodied and beaten, crying on the floor, and you see the mother with her hands on the sink, holding it. What do you do? My student said, I go to the child. The intake person said, you're not ready to do this yet. You go to the mother. Okay.
Could you say a little bit more about the Vajrayana anger?
Vajra anger. Dorje Trolo Shedong Chu. Yeah, okay. The Vajra Kalaya Tantra, in the root Tantra text, is Zhedong Dorje Tro Chu. Zhedong is the word for anger, Dorje is the word for Vajra, so Vajra anger. Tro is another word for anger, and chu is the word for cut. So it is vajra anger cuts anger. Or anybody think of another word for anger for me?
Wrath.
Yeah, but wrath. Okay, we could say vajra wrath cuts anger. Would be better. Okay, now, Conktrol in his explanation of this says that what is Vajra anger? It is compassion. And compassion, and what is compassion? Compassion is the clarity of mind itself, or mind nature. He goes on to say that compassion and anger are mutually incompatible in the same way that heat and cold are incompatible. You can't have something that's both hot and cold. You can't have both anger and compassion at the same time. This doesn't mean getting angry. What it means is that as the situation arises, the energy that would normally go into anger arises as the clarity of mind. You see exactly what needs to be done, and that is the manifestation of compassion. So in the example that I was just giving, you come into this abuse situation and you see what needs to be done, which the mother is completely messed up because she was angry enough to hit her child, and she's also now upset with the child. She's totally alienated from everything. You get her present so that she can make peace with the child. But if you go to the child first, you increase the alienation of the mother, and you actually make the situation much more difficult to work with. And this is really hard stuff. And I'm just using that as one example. When you encounter situations in which there goes back to a discussion we were having in another context. In an oppressed situation, it's only going to stop when the oppressor stops. So that's where you need to direct the energy. It's how do you get the oppressor to stop? And from a Buddhist point of view, this is a little hard for people in our culture. From a Buddhist point of view, the oppressed is reaping the effects of previous bad karma. The oppressor is creating bad karma. Who do you have more compassion for? You follow?
Yeah.
You know, the oppressor is at the beginning of the whole karmic process and is creating a whole world for him or herself, which is going to be imbued with suffering for the oppressed, even though it's very, very unpleasant. It's the end of the karmic process. I mean, this is a very, very different way from the way that we normally view situations. But it's very powerful.
I have a much less profound anger question. So my house is broken into during the retreat.
Yes.
And I come back and I go to Home Depot and I buy new hinges and a much better quality strike plate and floodlights with a motion detector, and my landlord comes over and installs them for me. And my landlord basically believes that his responsibility is to collect rent checks and nothing else. And so I say, would you like to reimburse me now, or would you like me to take it off the rent? And he says, I'm not paying for this. I installed it. Why would I pay for the materials? And besides, the house was never broken into when I lived here. Is there a place for righteous anger in this?
What would righteous anger accomplish?
Given that the shovel that they used to break open the door was right there, I seriously considered using it.
I'm sure I can relate. I mean, but...
No, it would not have accomplished anything. But he didn't stop me from feeling both righteous and angry.
Yeah, and I had a similar experience last night myself and didn't handle it very well. But I was very frustrated and very angry, and I wasn't living this stuff right at that moment. We get angry when we feel that we are weaker than what we are opposing. I love telling CEOs that. It takes them a little while to get to it. But they said, you know, and I said, so you feel weaker than your direct report?
No!
So we have a very interesting discussion. But that's basically if you put it into the five elements, we feel weaker than what we're opposing. We feel isolated, rejected, and so we get angry in order to get out of that experience. Now, what I have found very helpful when I'm in situations that are causing me frustration is, what am I trying to accomplish here? What is the result that I actually want? And that allows me to engage the situation completely. And when I engage the situation completely, I'm not angry. Because when you're angry, you are necessarily regarding yourself as separate from the situation. The situation's there, and I'm here. When you engage the situation completely, you're no longer separate from it. And so now it just becomes a matter of working strategy. Susan.
I don't know if this directly relates to what we're talking about, but a couple classes ago when we were discussing taking and sending, and you had mentioned that sometimes it's hard if there's something inside of you that mm-hmm. you don't know, it's opposing you, but you're not quite sure you can overcome it. It kind of relates to what we're talking about now, an experience that I had. A few weeks ago, my nephew was kind of, he was taken by surprise and attacked and kind of brutalized. And I didn't know how I could do taking and sending with the attacker, because I wasn't feeling much compassion. Or I think I said at the time that I felt like I was sort of in two worlds, that one part of me kind of saw, but the other part of me didn't feel it. The other part wanted revenge or whatever. But then after hearing what you had to say, I realized that that I was not regarding the attacker's suffering as having the same value as my nephew's suffering. And so once I saw that I needed to do that, it really did shift everything. And it also made me think of the line, rest in great equanimity without preference or prejudice, because I definitely had preference and prejudice in that situation.
Yeah. So that's right. Yeah. Okay. So we're talking about anger here. Let's turn to desire. Anger, in many ways, is easier to work with than desire, because most of the time it is a less pleasurable feeling, and the results of anger are less pleasant. Desire can be quite difficult. So he writes, sensual pleasures are like salty water. The deeper you drink, the thirstier you become. Now, can desires ever be satisfied? Temporarily, at best. That is the characteristic of the human realm, that we enjoy something and then we want more. So we go out and work hard and get it, and we enjoy it again, and then we want more. Different from the hungry ghost realm, you never get to enjoy anything in that. It's just never enough. In the human realm, you enjoy and you want more, you enjoy, you want more, and so it goes. And that's why he writes, sensual pleasures are like salty water. The deeper you drink, the thirstier you become. Any object that you attach to, right away, let it go. How do you let something go?
Recognize it as a manifestation of mind?
How do you do that? Because as we know, that at the intellectual level, that doesn't work at all. You've tried that, have you?
Tried it. How do you drop the sense of other?
Well, yeah, that's true, but how do you do that?
I think I might be lost here.
Okay. Anybody else? Randy?
Hopefully you recognize it as an instability or an imbalance. When you're attached to something, because it's not vapid, but it evaporates. It leaves and then comes back. So there's no stability there.
Okay, so how do you recognize it as an imbalance? What do you have to do in order to recognize it as an imbalance? Diane?
I think you have to ask yourself what it is.
Remember the four techniques? You can use any of the four, but all of them in one way move you into the experience of it. So even though it says let it go, on the outer level that we've discussed various levels before, you know, you let it go, you just don't engage it. But at a deeper level, and what is more effective, is that when that desire arises, you experience it completely. I think we did this the other night, a couple of weeks ago, but we can do it again because I think it's helpful. Pick an object which you are attracted to. It can be another person. It can be a like a car or some clothes or flowers or whatever, but pick something that you are attracted to. Pick something that you desire, a watch or, you know, whatever. Just imagine it in front of you right now. And feel the desire. I'd really like that. That would look really nice in my house or my apartment. Now, how do you experience the desire? What are the physical sensations connected with the experience of desire? What's happening in your body? What are all the emotional sensations? You know, we have the desire itself and anticipation and a certain grasping quality, all of those little things in there. Just experience all of them. Maybe there's a little jealousy creeping in or a little competition somewhere or other. Maybe there's a feeling of not deserving. Just everything connected with the desire. Just experience it. And all of the stories. So you have your physical sensations, emotional sensations, all the mental stories, and so forth. You're right in the experience of that desire. Now look at the object again. How do you experience the object now? Anybody? Where's
I'm thinking of that famous Dali painting called The Great Masturbator. And it seems to me that that may come on you, that sensuality. And you can see where you're losing chi or whatever you want to call it, or where it has
but
poor overtones.
Did you?
Where.
Yes, but all of that is assessment in the way that we were talking at the retreat. But what happened when you moved into the experience of desire in the way that I was describing?
Of releasing it?
No, of just experiencing. What happened? What happened when you moved into the experience of desire? Anybody else?
Cooled out.
It cooled. Okay. Dan?
I was going to say it was more like love or compassion rather than the clinging
right.
of desire.
And when you looked at the object again, what was that like?
Well, that's what I mean. When I looked at the object again, that's what I felt was...
So it wasn't the wanting quality.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, that's how you let desire go, is by experiencing not the object, but the desire completely. And as you were saying, John, it cools.
But this may not even have an object there either.
Well, you may see it differently, yeah.
What I experienced was that the object was totally separate from all of my desire. That it was its own thing, and my desire was not part of that object.
Yeah, so there's much greater clarity. Mm. Yeah, very good. Kate?
What I experienced is that it's like a feeling realization that the object wouldn't create all these great, you know, things that I think it would create for me.
So again, you see things clearer from another perspective.
Yeah, it's yeah. it's like you see through the projections that you've put on the object.
Very good. Yeah. So this is how you let go of desire, by experiencing it completely. And both of yours, you say it cut through the projections. You're saying it, you saw the actual relationship, the desire, as something distinct from the object. Yep. Okay.
Feel the suffering. I mean, if you do taking and sending, then all the suffering of that desire.
Of the you feel that the nature that of desire itself is a form of suffering. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Sure.
I got really hung up on the words right away, which I think is the whole essence of this verse.
You want to enjoy it a little bit first?
Yeah,
do you?
I just wanted to hang out. I did. Every time I read it, the right away just jumped out at me, and I said, no, not right away. Well,
there you are. I mean, being awake means right away. You're not holding on to that little bit of enjoyment. A little bit of enjoyment can get you in an awful lot of trouble. Yeah. But that's your choice.
I go to a place of thinking that this is all very joyless. You know, we're not supposed to really enjoy anything.
Well, we are at this point addicted to certain kinds of enjoyment. And I use the term addicted quite intentionally. At first, when we experience that more open sense of just straight appreciation, it feels like it lacks the excitement and the energy. But, you know, that's exactly what an addict feels when they get sober. You know, you don't have that big roller coaster. And it's a different way of experiencing the world. But to say that it is joyless is not the case at all. There's a deeper and, yes, a quieter joy. Which is actually much less dependent on circumstances. Because you aren't caught up in reaction, primarily. But coming to appreciate that is a particularly when we come from a background where we have little experience of it, that actually does take some time.
So that's a sort of difference between so just looking at a flower, for instance, or like wanting to pick it.
Yes, that's a very good way. Just appreciating the flower there, or saying, no, I need to have this and take it home. That's a good analogy. Yeah. Okay. We're over time. Let's do 22, 23, and 24. And what these have to do with, and then we'll be into the six perfections after that. 22, 23, and 24 all have to do with the nature of experience. And then we have a couple of weeks on the six perfections, and then we're into some other stuff. Okay?